UK Wine Show, show number 124. Peter Bonn on East Germany. On this week's award-winning wine show, we're talking about wines from East Germany with Peter Bonn from Weingutschloss Praschwitz. We talk with Peter about the fall of the Berlin Wall and making wine under communist times.
And in the news, functional wines on trial, France confused over wine online, and new label that detects spoilt wine.
G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 124 for the 26th of September, 2008. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show we're talking with Peter Bonn from Weingutschloss Praschwitz. We talk with Peter about the fall of the Berlin Wall and what it's like making wine under communist times. In the spotlight, we take a break from soils and terroir for a couple of weeks while we review the book The Business of Wine, A Global Perspective. And since I enjoyed it so much last week, we're going to run the quote through the show this week as well. So this week, the quote is, "Men are like wine. Some turn to vinegar, but the best improve with age." Who said that? Clues throughout the show, the answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. California's wine industry has begun using a temperature-sensitive label that tracks the wine's temperature during distribution and can thereby detect any spoilage. The label's produced by PackSense and has been used in the food industry for around 2 years. It's normally attached to the case of wine and is programmed to reflect a band of temperatures. If a shipment stays within desired parameters, a light flashes green, but if temperatures get too high or low, it flashes yellow.
Sounds like a great idea. Although I worry less about the wine being shipped than when they're in the shop sitting under fluorescent lights. It's certainly not the best for slow-moving wines, which is exactly what happens to expensive wines in shops. And also, the pack doesn't give you any consumer confidence. Let's face it, with no markings on the bottle, just the box, the wine could have been fried, and the wine still sold to a customer who's none the wiser. The big use is in shipping wines by container, especially when they travel through the tropics. What's next, Jane?
Well, confusion over the legality of wine advertising in France is driving companies to self-censorship. In the 1991 Evin Law, the internet was not included in a specific list of allowable advertising mediums for wine, and so it's actually illegal to advertise online in France. Rather than risk prosecution, companies are banning advertising from wine companies on their websites. And some drinks websites are banning visitors from France from entering their sites, including Camus Cognac and Orlando Wines, which is owned by Pernod Ricard. And the confusion goes beyond the internet. In January, Le Parisien newspaper was fined because of an article on champagne, which was considered as advertising. And now magazines and newspapers will often follow articles about wine with a government health warning on alcohol abuse. A television channel recently used that same health warning before showing the documentary film Mondovino. Wine writer Jack Dupont in La Pointe sums it up by arguing, how can we on the one hand celebrate our fine wines and then treat those who produce them like drug dealers? What do you think, Chris?
Well, let's not muck around here. While wine is fantastically interesting and a complex beverage, it is a socially acceptable recreational drug. It needs to be regulated. The question is, where is the correct balance? France in the past has been fairly loose with wine even being allowed to sell on eBay, which is banned in the UK. Where France has set its balance is up to it and the social norms within the country. What does not help, though, is a change in policy and a very different way of interpreting the law. This is sloppy government. There is a lack of clear definition over what is legal, and as a result, responsible companies land up with significant self-censorship in this information vacuum. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, functional wines with added antioxidants could be available in the UK. That's provided the European Commission approves the special winemaking process that's involved. The wines contain 100 milligrams per litre of the antioxidant resveratrol, compared with a typical 1 milligram per litre in normal white wines and 3 to 6 milligrams per litre in reds. The patented process involves extracting the resveratrol from grapes before concentrating it and adding it back to the wine. The wines are currently being tried in Australia and are being produced by Pendarves Estate REW. That's it for me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories in full on our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Well, my sort of longer on resveratrol, great, I'll drink to that. But are functional wines what we really want? Fair enough, all they're doing is concentrating resveratrol, which is in the grapes, so it could be considered wine. But this new category of wine, why does it need to exist? We have functional bread with extra omega-3, and why not extra resveratrol in your bread, or baked beans perhaps? From a health perspective, there's no need for it to be in wine. Sure, it is in wine naturally, but at such low dosage it's insignificant. I thought the story was beautiful, coming just after the Dispatches documentary on additives in wine. Do we really want a natural product or a made product? It's a bit like advertising in France. What is the balance? Now, I have no problems with adding things to wine, such as sugar and natural wine essence, and in certain circumstances, not even water. But I don't see the need for functional wines. Next, we'll be enriching it with vitamin C and omega-3. And then what do we get? That pretty much ends the news. How are you going on with that quote? Let me give it to you again. Men are like wine. Some turn to vinegar, but the best improve with age. Now, I'm not going to tell you who it is, but whoever it is, he was born in 1881 and died on the 3rd of June 1963. Being Italian, during World War I, he was drafted into the Royal Italian Army as a sergeant, serving in the medical corps as a stretcher bearer and as a chaplain. Have we think about that. Next up, we've got the spotlight, and this week we're reviewing the book The Business of Wine, A Global Perspective. It's available from CBS Press at £15.84. The authors are Per Jenster, David Smith, Daryl Mitry, and Lars Jenster. As the opening sentence in The Business of Wine says, many books have been written about the pleasure and pursuit of good wine. However, this is not the purpose of this book. The authors offer a unique and very detailed view of the modern wine industry. That's their opening quote. And I certainly think the book is not a pleasurable experience on wine. The book is an academic text written by academics for students. In other words, it's a bit of a boring read. So, bearing that in mind, and realizing it's not a riveting read, it does represent the current world situation in wine, and it's quite thought-provoking. It also tries to get under the sheets of the wine industry and see how it really works. It gives a historical perspective to the production and buying of wine, primarily from a European perspective, but also covering the US in some depth. Other regions are included, but since the book is limited to 198 pages, the depth is limited. Now, I'm pleased I read it, but at the same time, particularly early on while I was reading it, I wished I was doing something else. It didn't answer any of the questions I wanted to know, but at the same time, it offered answers to questions I hadn't even thought about. This is because the author's point of view is very different to many wine writers, and as a result, The Business of Wine gives a different perspective. So, who would read this book? Well, not a wine enthusiast. Sorry, it'll probably put you off wine. I think a student is the real target, particularly those needing a good overview. Perhaps a Wine and Spirit Education Trust diploma student, or maybe an MW starting out. Another thankful reader will probably be someone entering the wine industry for the first time, probably in a management position. Now, The Business of Wine is full of facts and figures, and only about a third of them are up to date. Many are about 2 to 5 years old, and the authors appear not to have commissioned any new research for the book. But The Business of Wine is often trying to show trends, so cutting-edge figures is not always required. What the book does well is it gives a very high-level overview of the UK, French, US and Italian wine markets, both production and consumption. It also shows how the markets are interrelated and how they've developed over the last 100 years. There are 10 chapters in The Business of Wine, covering a general overview of markets and vineyards of the world. Chapter 1 and 2 set the scene with an overview of marketing and vineyards of the world. There are some interesting statistics, such as Germany is the largest importing wine country in the world. Chapter 2 also goes into Vineyards of the World, which covers 52 pages, or a quarter of the book. It really was not necessary, as it covers areas that are better covered in other books. Chapter 3, on consumer behaviour, breaks consumers into categories and gives some statistics on different drinking patterns in different countries. At this point, I was starting to warm up to the book. Chapter 4, on page 91, so almost halfway through the book, is where many people should start reading. It describes the main product categories of wine. And in Chapter 5, we're starting to flesh out some of the changes in production of wine. By Chapter 6, titled The History and Development of the Distribution System, a catchy little title if I've ever heard one, we're starting to get into the meat of the book, and you start to get some payback for all those early hard-going chapters. With a good history on the development of wine marketing in the last 100 years. Through it, it shows the strengths and weaknesses of a number of wine suppliers in the world, and why the market is currently structured in this slimmed-down but still very complex way. Chapter 7 looks at the marketing in a fairly high level, general trends, and a shift to discounters, as well as a quick overview of different packaging options. I found the packaging options quite interesting, and it helps explain why some markets like some types of packaging, while others don't. Chapter 8 is an excellent chapter and gives examples of a number of different types of wine producing companies and how they differentiate themselves within the market. I found it gave me enough information on the larger companies to start thinking about how they strategically position themselves. Chapter 9 looks at the history of the EU wine regulation from the wine wars in Italy and France to today's current legislative situation. Chapter 10 finishes off the book by focusing on the future consumption patterns in Europe and the emphasis on convergence in consumption patterns between the north and south of Europe. While this book is a bit long and is quite academic, it contains some fantastic thought-provoking insights and ideas. If you're a student or a new manager in the wine industry, it's a great starting point. And while The Business of Wine, A Global Perspective can be read in a weekend, it does not need to be read cover to cover. The more you know, the more initial chapters you might want to skip. That said, the later chapters were excellent. In the end, I rated this book 85 out of 100. That ends this week's Spotlight. Next week, we're looking at the results from this month's poll, which is, if you're not sure, which glass size do you prefer to be served in a pub? Do go to our site, 3050.co.uk, click on podcast, and you can enter our poll on the right-hand side. I noticed while I was reading The Business of Wine, there were some statistics on Saxony, or Sachsen, I think that's how you say it, as it's known. Saxony in East Germany, where Peter Bonn, our interviewee, is from, has 446 hectares under vine and is the smallest commercial wine region in Germany. When you compare this to Germany's largest region, Rheinhessen, at 26,333 hectares and the Mosel on 10,392, 446 hectares is very small. So, next up, let's talk to Peter Bonn from Saxony on the recent history of East German wines and try and get an understanding of this small, niche region. Hi, I'm here with Peter Bonn. You are the marketing man for Schloss Proschwitz. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Did I get it right?
Yes.
Excellent.
So, but you see, it's a problem when you are a marketing man and a salesman and doing the strategy for Schloss Proschwitz. It's not easy to do that in England because the name is not easy to spell in England.
No, that's fine. You're a bit weird from a normal German wine point of view in that you guys are actually based in East Germany.
Yeah, we are based in East Germany, in the heart of Saxony, in the so-called Elbtal, you know, the river Elbe, which is going, you can say, from around Prague to Hamburg. Mm-hmm. So, and it's a beautiful scenery. It's, let me say, 45, 50 kilometers where the wine is concentrated on, always across the river Elbe. And it's really a nice climate where you can do wines. Otherwise, it wouldn't be it wouldn't be for 800 years there.
So you've been there for 800 years. That's an awful long time.
Yes, could be. But not yeah. us, but the
not
wine.
Yourself personally,
the wine, the wine is in fact there for more than 800 years, and. It was always, I think it's the same like in England, it was always the church which is...
controlling it all, yeah.
Right, right. And it is funny because we have completely different times. We had times in the 17th century where we had 6,000 hectares of wine growing area. And now we have 470 hectares, which
quite
makes us the second smallest wine growing area in Germany.
You say the region's got about 400 hectares of vines. How big is Schloss Proschwitz?
Schloss Proschwitz is around 80 hectares now. The region is 470 hectares officially, and we have 80 hectares.
Are they all under vine?
No, we have 30 hectares from these 80 hectares where we have new plants, and we need another 2-3 years until we get the first wine from it, because in wine business it's very, very important to be careful in the first years. So you give all your care and love to the grapes, especially in the first years, and not doing harvest too early.
One of the things I'm quite interested in is to understand maybe some of the history, the recent history, maybe changing from when it was originally United Germany through what happened to the region during the East German time, and now through to what's happened, because I understand you're one of the first to get VDP status as well.
Yeah, it was in 96, very early, and this was very motivating for us because we get in contact with all the good VDP estates. Especially on the exhibitions, and we learned a lot from that. We really learned a lot. And before it was a very hard time because, you know, the wine in 1990 was the techniques, all the techniques and knowledge was not like in West Germany because it was a closed system. In the 80s, you couldn't go to French or Italian winemakers or other West German winemakers and ask for information. It was also difficult to buy special techniques, machines, tanks, all this. This was very, very difficult. So we didn't have the quality in 1990, 91, 92, but we had to work and we had to invest a lot, and this in a very, very quick time. Let me say it a little bit provocant. We had to do a lot of things in 15, 20 years where other wine estates had 300 years.
Where were you? You know, what was the East German wine industry like at the end of World War II, or you know, maybe during that period? Was there quite a strong East German wine scene?
And the father of Prince zur Lippe was expropriated in 1945. He had a well-running wine estate and also 500,000 hectares of agricultural area. He had also houses in Dresden, but he lost everything by the expropriation. Right, in 1945 by the Russians, and he in 1990 he didn't get back one hectare, so he had to buy everything, but he couldn't buy everything, of course. So it is 80 hectares now, and we bought back the castle, and we bought back very old estate which we reconstructed. Which we reconstruct even now with very modern cellar technique and so on. So we had to invest a lot of money, a lot of tears, and a lot of work. But before 1990 and after the Second World War, it was not the best time for the wine because it was not supported by the state, by the GDR.
GDR is like the old Eastern,
the old DDR, the old East German government, right? And they concentrate on the bigger agricultural business, not on wine. It was too small, and that was the reason why the and we are very proud on this. Why the private persons, I think around 3-4 thousand private persons, did all the wine. They grow the wine, and they brought the grapes to the cooperative. That was the only company who sold the wine. Mm-hmm. There was also a state, of course, a state-owned wine estate called Schloss Wackerbarth, and the cooperative was the most important company, and they collected all the grapes by the private people, and then they sold the wine, and it was very, very rare. It was so difficult to get a bottle of GDR wine. It was so difficult that, it was very worth. You know, high status, right? I know people, even in my team in Proschwitz, people who are working, the only ones who get advantages in the apprenticeship because they had a few bottles of Saxonian wine. When you want to, when people had repaired cars or want the car repairs, it was much easier with two or three bottles of Saxonian wine.
So you go, here's my Trabi, those funny cars.
Trabi, right. Yeah. It was a currency for repairing a Trabi much faster.
Was the wine any good?
This is a question maybe you can answer in a very arrogant way and say, no, it was really not good. It was really not good.
Yeah.
But I think you had to show respect before the time. And when you see there was less knowledge, there was no technique, and they did wine in a very primitive way. And I had respect for that. It was not what I was used to and what I like, but it was wine, and it was made under not very well, not under good, how do you say, surroundings.
Probably not very clean.
Not very clean. Right? Yeah. But it was made, and that was the most important.
Is there any wine left over from those periods? Have you tried stuff?
There are wines, yeah, and I tried it, but
You wouldn't recommend it to people?
No.
We've actually tried. I've just come and tried some of your wines at we're recording this at the Mainz VDP trade show, and I came through and I tried some of your wines before we came down here and did the interview. And They were pretty good. I thought they were maybe lacking some intensity, but the ice wine you gave me at the end was quite nice. Again, maybe a wee bit of acidity missing from there, but generally it was. You know, I'd be more than happy to drink that. I thought it was good stuff.
It's to the thing you said is the intensity.
Yeah,
yeah. This is now I'm a wine drinker for a long time, and first, you look for aroma, you look for intensity. But when you drink more and more wine, you look for finesse.
Balance.
For balance, for finesse, for elegance. And that is not always the pure intensity. So you're right, in 2007 was a fine year for the lighter ones, but it was not a good one for the wines we also made in the last years, for the more powerful ones. I'm not sure, did you try the...
I tried your O5.
Pinot Gris Barrique.
No, I tried your Spat Burgunder from 2005, Pinot Noir from 2005.
Okay, yeah.
That was on the nose. It had a lovely sort of, you know, Pinot nose, nice and cherry, or all that sort of stuff. Maybe a wee bit weak through the mid palate, but quite good. I gave it a good rating. Yeah. I thought it was nice.
Okay.
What price does those sort of wines sell for?
We sell from the estate this Pinot Noir for €22, which is how much pounds?
By the time you convert the pound to the euro and then you add VAT and duty and all that, it's probably about the same.
Okay. So 22, but it's 2006, will be filled in September, and this will be much more stuffy. You see, when you try the Dornfelder from 2006, you will see it's more stuffy in 2006, more fruit, more concentrated.
Are you quite seasonal? Like, do you feel the climate change? You know, a good year will make quite a difference to your vineyard.
We do that. We do that. There are a lot of critics who said, you make wines like in former times, you only know from the Mosel or from the Rheingau. You still have this wonderful acidity, this well-balanced acidity. This is something which makes it also interesting for other areas in the north. You won't believe, but I visited two estates in Denmark. They have 23 or 21 estates in Denmark, and they make pretty nice wines.
Yeah.
On the island of Bornholm, for example, and even in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern, which is in the most northern state in Germany, they produce wine. And you can feel it and you can read it on the labels. When you ask your parents or your grandparents what they drink from Germany, for example, they loved the wines with 9, 10, 11% of alcohol. And increasing. Sometimes you get wines from Baden with 15.5% of alcohol. This is the climate change. You can read on the label.
And I suppose where I was getting to was more some regions, like things like Marlborough or a lot of the Australian stuff, they seem to have quite consistent quality year on year. Do you guys feel the different climate, get a change in weather from one year to the next?
You have to be extremely flexible, extremely. When you want to work like, oh, we do that every year in the same way. We do the harvest of Müller-Thurgauer Riesling on 22nd of October, for example. You won't succeed in Germany, and you especially won't succeed in East Germany, because you have to be very flexible. So in some days we decide at 5-6 o'clock in the morning, no, we don't do the harvest now. We call the 40 people, stop, tomorrow we try again. Or sometimes we decide to go on another vineyard. Yeah, you have to do that very flexible. But it's a question also of globalization and what style of wine you like. It's on the one hand for the mass producers very important to do standards, because you want to communicate these standards, and for that is important to have the same quality, the same sensoric profile every year. And then it's good when you come from an area where you have the same harvest conditions every year. But in Germany, we really are, and we should, I think we should communicate this, we are an area of different vintages, completely different. And when you are into wine and you try the 1967 or 69 or compare it with 82 or maybe the last 3 years, 2005, 6, 7, this is really fun. And this is talking about wine, but also talking about characters, because every vintage, every wine is different, and I think it's good. Not every vintage has to be like 2003, completely full flavored, stuffy. It's also good when you serve different food, for example, antipasti, special fish, etc. You need lighter wine, so don't only look on the grape, on the producer. Also look on the vintage.
One of the things that I'm picking up from talking to German producers at the moment is that particularly growers on the quite steep slopes who aren't in the best sites find it quite hard to make wines economically because of labour costs. What are the labour costs like on the East Germany at the moment? Are they similar to the West now, or are they, you know, do you have problems with labour? And is your vineyard laid out for machine harvesting, or is it laid out for hand harvesting?
We do most hand harvesting. We do a little bit for the quality wines in the cabinets with the machine, but don't think machine is much more easy, because you do the before you use the machine, you do a negative selection. You have to put all away you don't want to harvest, and therefore you need also 20-30 people who go through the vineyard. So it's hard work. The costs are high because we have really low average quantity, harvest quantity per hectare. In Germany, you can say we have 90 until 100 hectoliters per hectare. In Saxony, it was 45 until 50 in the last 10 years. Yeah, okay. So that's not a lot. So we only had one chance. We only can concentrate on our sensoric profile, which is based on the terroir and on the quality. That is the only possibility. Otherwise, we can't compete in a market with wines. We can't compete with wines who were sold in supermarkets. It's not possible.
Sure. I suppose, but is your labor cost in East Germany similar to the labor costs in West Germany?
The costs are the same, but the difference is the people working in our vineyards are from the area, from Meissen, from Dresden, and the people working in the vineyards during the harvest, for example, in the Mosel, are most times, for example, from Poland. Mm. Yeah, but in East Germany, the people are used to work very hard. So they're coming from Meissen and around Meissen.
So you don't have any problems getting hold of labor?
But it's the complete agricultural business. It doesn't matter if you do Spargel, what is Spargel? Asperge, or you do wine, is not good paid. So it's not like you can earn 12, 15, 20 euro per hour. It's less, of course.
Sure. Yeah. No, that makes sense, doesn't it? when the wall came down,
yeah,
what was the what happened in the first couple of years? What happened in a couple of years after that? You know, what was the first couple of years?
The first year was interesting because the prince stood in the vineyards, and he was a very successful consultant for the famous consultant Roland Berger, and he was also working as a manager for successful companies in Germany. And he asked himself, is it worth continuing the history of the family in Saxony? And he was the youngest of six children of his parents. And he was talking with his father in the 80s, talking about Saxony, about what was and what will be. And then suddenly there was a possibility of doing something in Meißen. And the first thing was to buy the grapes and to buy the ground. And after that, it was a funny story. In 91, when we did the first harvest, Prince Zalippe had the grapes, but not the cellar.
Yeah.
So he tried to get a possibility to make wine out of the grapes, because he didn't want to become a special producer for Rosinen, yeah, for this small concentrated. We call it Rosinen in Germany.
Oh, okay, yeah. Raisins.
Right, raisins, yeah. And for that reason, he used the old, I can only say it in German, Betriebskampfwagen, the old military vehicle from the LPG, from the cooperative. And he put the grapes on this, and he went 400 kilometers to Franconia, to the famous wine estate Castel, which is related to, and they did the wine for us.
Oh, okay, nice.
And then he put the bottles on the vehicle and put it back to Saxony. So this was really funny. And then we started with our own small cellar, and I joined the estate after finishing my study in 96. And we had this kind of garage estate. You only know from the IT business, but we had this too. We had a garage estate with one laptop, two members, and we didn't have a heater. In 96, we had a winter with 28 degrees minimum, and we didn't have
Fahrenheit,
a heating system.
Yeah.
No, Celsius.
A minus 28.
28 degrees minus.
Oh, that is
Celsius.
Cold.
Yeah. So this was pretty cold. And we had these gas burners. And it was funny because some people who visited us said, what are you doing? Why no one?
Why is it so cold?
Yeah, and we bought some tanks. And it continues and continues. And then we bought this old estate. And then we created our own building company. So we don't have only a wine estate, a distillery. We also have a building company. And then the next years, it was, we have now more than 500 events in a year, or even the president of Germany, the ambassadors, and a lot of companies visit us to have fine dining with very good cooks, with star cooks, and drink the wines there in tastings. And so we had to create our own event company. So every year, every 2 years, we do something new.
Yep.
We are planning our own restaurant, which is concentrated on regional good food. How do you say, not ecological food, biological food. Yeah, so we try to do that. And it's every year you have something new to do.
Okay then, Peter, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate. I hope you enjoyed that interview. I was hoping to paint a picture of wine growing in Saxony before, during and after communism. I think it's nice to have a look at some regions we don't always think of. But that ends this week's interview. Next week, we're going to be talking with Jancis Robinson, Master of Wine, and one of the most influential wine writers in the world. We talked to her about a typical day for Jancis. Now, before we finish up, there's a couple of things you may want to know about. The first is, I'm doing a live video podcast, or a vodcast, on Thursday, the 2nd of October at 7 p.m. The link is available from montanavintageexperience.com. That's all one word, montanavintageexperience.com. And Montana's running some fantastic competitions to win up to 6 trips to New Zealand for you and your partner. So that's a fantastic trip and well worth looking at. If you receive the newsletter, you'll probably get that mailed to you on Wednesday, because the newsletter's going out on Wednesday. If you're not a normal subscriber to the newsletter, it's a great opportunity to see what's happening.
And it's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website, 3050.co.uk. Just fill in your details. You can give me some information in the comments section if you want. And also make sure you select newsletter only. And finally, before we finish up, we've got five pairs of tickets to give away to the lucky listeners who would like to go to this year's wine show at the Islington Design Centre on the 23rd to the 26th of October. If you're keen, drop an email to Jane. You can get it to her at jane.scott@3050.co.uk. We need to know your postal address so we can mail the tickets out to you. So if you're interested in that, just give her an email. And to finish off with the quote, "Men are like wine, some turn to vinegar, but the best improve with age." Now here's a big clue. He was beatified in 2000. Any ideas? Well, originally named Angelo Giuseppe Roncalli, I'm not sure about the pronunciation, he was born in a small country village in the Provence of Bergamo, Italy. You may have heard of him and know him better as Pope John the 23rd. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.